Hello, I'm Dr. Pamela Brewer, and you are listening to Men's Monday here on Mind Talk, the show that provides you with relationship health and mental health information every day. On Men's Monday, we focus on all things for and about men. Today's guest is Dan Hartman. Dan, welcome to Mind Talk.
Thanks for having me on.
Dan, you and your wife, Susan, have a really interesting conversation to share with us, as you and your wife had many conversations before making the choices that you did. But I'd like to start with you as a little one. Talk to us about where you were born and what your early life was like growing up.
So I was actually born at Andrews Air Force Base, and growing up for me was, I think, a probably pretty typical suburban life, other than the fact that I had hemophilia, which is a genetic bleeding disorder, which required blood transfusions, or I should say blood product-derived transfusions.
Okay. And so...
That actually led to when I was 12 years old being diagnosed with HIV from those transfusions. And
that's a pretty big diagnosis.
Yes, it is.
And you were 12. How did that diagnosis come about? What was going on in your life at that point?
Pretty much, I think, what happens to most eighth graders. I it was at the beginning of sort of what we call the AIDS epidemic, and how do I want to say it? So it was definitely something that was going on in the culture and on the news, and I was aware of it in that kind of way. But I wasn't fully cognizant, that this might be something that would affect me, because they were talking about it, especially back then, as something that was affecting gay men, and then also, drug users and people that were having sex, all of which I was not doing any of those. And also, I hadn't really equated the fact that the product that I was using was derived from human blood, so I wasn't thinking that I had had a blood transfusion or anything like that. So it was just out of, the hospitals were doing routine testing of all the hemophilia patients to see, and I came up positive. And at the time, I don't think I was fully even cognizant of, what exactly it meant. Mm. So, I think that sort of started a long process of researching what the disease was and how it worked and all that kind of stuff, and, sort of keeping tabs on it.
So one day you were sort of an average eighth grader, just kind of doing your thing and hanging out. And then, clearly you had hemophilia. So there were some things that you had to be mindful of that I'm sure your parents talked to you about. But really you were like an average eighth grader. Is that a fair statement?
Yes, absolutely. So other than being sort of limited from sports and having to deal with, people can do research about hemophilia if they want to. But, it basically is an issue where you have bleeding into your joints and things like that because your blood doesn't clot effectively. So, other than having to deal with that and sort of explain why you might be on crutches one day at school and then not the next, pretty sort of average suburban sort of life.
And let's just stay with the eighth grade for a moment.
Sure.
Just the experience of being a hemophiliac. Did you talk to your friends at school about what that meant? Did they have any understanding? What understanding did you have? And what understanding did you share with your friends, if any, about what some of your challenges were?
Definitely my closer friends knew. And then, I have been lucky enough that I don't have a lot of outward sort of appearances of hemophilia that some people can get, like from joint damage and things like that. So, sort of more casual acquaintances at school or, you're just meeting someone, it wasn't really an issue. And I also, lucky or not, tend to be on the smaller side. So, you know, never had to explain why I wasn't interested in playing football or, you know, any of the sort of rougher sports or anything like that. That was, I was, even if I had been sort of quote unquote normal, that wouldn't have been really a path for me to go down anyway. So.
Okay. And was it something that you missed, or did you care, or were you relieved that you didn't have to worry about the sports?
I think I was sort of relieved in terms of that. And then also, you know, I think the one way that it manifested itself was actually towards high school. There was a short period of time where I was very disappointed that I would never be able to get into the Naval Academy. Although, looking back on it now, I'm very happy that I never wound up in the military, because I just mentally am not a military type person. So
gotcha. So let's now go. We're still in the eighth grade, and you find out. You and your parents find out that you are diagnosed with HIV. What was that like in your household? Do you remember?
You know, I think it was just sort of the sort of underlying level of stress that it created. And, you know, an extra level of sort of research that had to be done about what was going on. And also, this is another area where I was lucky enough that my father was a physician, so he could, you know, sort of keep tabs on the research in a way that, you know, maybe other families couldn't. And, but also, you know, I think there was just, and then also for myself, it's just, you know, at the time there weren't the drugs, only AZT was out at the time.
Okay.
And so the question was really, you know, is this going to be something that's, you know, you're going to be able to control, or are you just going to get sick and die at some point? And, you know, that has, until, you know, I would say around college, or, you know, maybe even my mid-20s, that was sort of really just sort of always sort of hanging over my head like the sort of Damocles kind of thing. So,
well,
you know.
Sure, because at the beginning of the, you know, a real awareness and hysteria in a lot of ways about HIV and being HIV positive, it was an automatic death sentence. That's what people thought.
Oh, absolutely. You know, and myself included. So, you know, it was, you know, and also at the time, just even the medical scientific community didn't know a lot about the disease. So, you know, they're just really what, you know, they just couldn't answer sort of basic questions of like, well, how long do you have? And are you going to be able to fight this on your own? Or are you going to have to take medication? Or, you know, just all those sort of questions that one would have about, you know, when they get sick with any kind of disease. So,
so lots of unknowns. And certainly as a young child, as a growing into being a teenager, the last thing that one expects to have to think about is their own mortality, whether or not they're going to actually live. Teenagers typically think they're going to live like for a million years. But that was taken away from you, I would think, in some respects, as you had the diagnosis of HIV, but perhaps with the diagnosis of being a hemophiliac as well.
Yes, in some ways, and then also in other ways, you know, I've been fortunate enough that I never had any illnesses from the HIV, so I was very lucky in that respect, and so in some ways, it was this tension because you're always worried or waiting for something to happen, or, you know, your close friends and family are always worried for you, like every time you get sick or, you know, catch a cold or something like that, or, you know, when you're going in, you know, every 6 months to 3 months to get your white blood cells levels checked and things like that, you know, everybody starts to worry. But in some ways it also feels very awkward because you're worrying and you're like, but I feel the same and I don't feel sick. And you know, it's not like I even have a runny nose there's just these tests telling you that you're sick and that if things don't go well, that you will get sick and all that kind of stuff. And it's a little difficult to wrap your head around.
I would think it would be really difficult to wrap your head around. Now, at one point, you and your dad kind of disclosed your status to the school, yes?
Yes. You know, I again, I feel like I'm using the word luck a lot in this conversation, but it truly is. Was lucky enough to have gone to the Key School in Annapolis, and it was a very small school population, and so knew my classmates very well. And, you know, it was just feeling very awkward that I couldn't, you know, I had this big issue in my life that I couldn't talk about. And so we actually coordinated with my social worker and my father and a large number of medical people to tell the whole school at once, just so that we could sort of get this issue out of the way. And the other thing is that now, sort of coming out about HIV, it's not that big a deal, but at the time,
absolutely,
you know, we were one of the first people to do this, and it was sort of coming right on the backs of Ryan White, who, you know, had to actually move to a whole other town and was completely ostracized from his original school and all that kind of stuff. So that's kind of the reality that we were sort of doing this disclosure in. So, again, we were very lucky that everyone was very accepting and understanding of the whole process. So, and has continued, you know, the friends that I have remained in touch with from high school have continued to remain supportive and you know, check in every once in a while about my HIV status. So.
You know, I can't imagine, I mean, it would be hard enough as an adult to make a disclosure to a large group of people all at one time. I can't imagine what it was like as a youngster to make a disclosure to your entire school. I mean, your dad was with you, which was the good thing, but that took so much courage on your part. Did you ever think about it in that way?
A little bit, but also, you know, it sort of also felt a lot like a pressure cooker, and, you know, it sort of like this secret that you have that's sort of building up and that you can't talk about and is causing a lot of emotion for you. And so to tell everyone at the school actually felt sort of like a release for that. So, you know, so it was kind of cathartic in some ways as well.
Okay. So it was a relief, and your schoolmates and the teachers were supportive of you.
Yes.
Which again, particularly at that time, is really quite something, because so many people were not.
Absolutely. You know, we had conversations about, you know, like, are you prepared to, you know, move schools if you have to, and, you know, if the students aren't accepting, or, you know, if there are, you know, how are we going to deal, you know, and if the school is accepting and the students are accepting, but the parents aren't, you know, how are we going to deal with that? And,
right.
You know, so there was a lot of thought before, you know, so it wasn't like I just walked in one day and sort of announced that I had HIV.
Right.
You know,
right.
There was a lot of thought and preparation that went into this whole process. So.
I would think so for you as well as the family, because now, you know, just your sort of whole life is being made bare in a way that you didn't necessarily anticipate the day before the diagnosis.
Yeah. I think, you know, for me, ultimately, I feel like communication is the key to working through sort of any problem.
Mm-hmm.
And so it felt to me like, you know, this was an area in my life where communication had stopped, and that was more important than, mm-hmm. you know, people's potential misunderstandings or their reactions to it, because I felt like if at least we could be in conversation about it, there's the potential to move through whatever fear or issues that people might have. And actually, most of the time, in my experience anyway, is that people actually want to help, and so, you know, actually telling school actually, you know, just sort of increased my support network. So, and that's sort of what I was counting on.
Wonderful.
Ultimately.
Wonderful. Dan Hartman, we are going to take a break, and when we return, we will continue with Dan's story. So don't go away. We'll be right back.
every man walks his own path. Let's return to a look at this man's path.
Dan, at some point, now we stayed at eighth grade for a while, but now we're going to fast forward, and you've gone through high school, and at some point you met this person by the name of Susan, who was like kind of important in your life. Tell us about when you met your now wife, Susan.
Well, I actually met Susan on the first day of high school, and throughout high school, you know, we became friends, and then just sort of over the course of time, you know, we went off to college and sort of lost touch for, I think, about 6 years, I want to say. And at that point, you know, I was living in upstate New York where I had gone to college, and she had moved out to California. And I was still just sort of thinking about that girl, Susan, that I had always wanted to date and even managed to go to the prom with, but, you know, I just wondered whatever happened to her. And so I looked her up and called her, and we just started this, you know, couple-hour-long phone conversation, catching up. And I think I, at some point during that conversation, said, you know what, we should go out on a date sometime. And she was like, well, if you're ever in California, sure, come on by. And then that just led to a whole bunch of, you know, really long sort of conversations as we were reconnecting, because we were such good friends in high school, that then she finally flew out you know, a couple months after that for a visit to upstate New York to visit me on one of her breaks. She was a teacher at the time, and the rest is history. You know, we dated long distance for a year, and then I moved out to California to be with her, and we were together, and then finally got married, and there you have it.
And there you have it. Was she surprised to hear from you after 6 years?
Yes. Yes, she was. she spent, I think, literally like the first few minutes of the phone call just sort of screaming into the phone, oh my gosh, Dan Hartman, I haven't talked to you in forever. So, and I think she wound up missing because she was getting ready to head out to go out with friends or something like that. And like I said, you know, we had this couple-hour-long conversation of just catching up, and I think she wound up missing that whole event, you know, and we were interrupted several times in that with her friends calling in and being like, are you ready to go yet? And she'd be like, yes, just a few more minutes. I just, like, this friend I haven't spoken to in 6 years. I want to talk to him. And so, yeah.
Kind of sounds
like definitely
it was
surprised.
Kind of sounds like it was meant to be.
Yeah, it sort of feels like that. You know, everything sort of just fell into place. So,
did you date much in high school?
I dated some, but I wouldn't say that I dated much. You know, it's always relative, right? So I'm sure compared to some people, I dated a lot. Compared to other people,
gotcha.
Not
yeah.
very much.
Yeah.
So. Yeah, I'd say I was probably average, slightly below average in terms of the number of people I dated.
Okay.
So.
You said that you and Susan were in a long-distance relationship for a year. And so many times people say that long-distance relationships don't work. Other people swear by them, and when they get to be shorter distance, that's when they fall apart. What do you think made it work for the two of you, that long-distance year?
I think, again, it comes back to that whole communication thing.
Mm-hmm.
And also, we didn't just start the relationship in terms of being long distance.
Gotcha.
You know, we had the whole high school experience.
Okay.
Even though we weren't dating or romantically involved in high school, you know, we had all that history going for us as well. So I think that definitely helped as well.
So, again, it sounds like we're underscoring the importance of communications in a relationship.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, at some point, you and Susan decided to marry.
Yes.
When you, after that year of the long distance, when you moved out to California, did you move out to marry, or was that in your head when you moved out, or is that something that happened down the road?
We both, I think, were like, let's give this a shot with the idea that in the long term, you know, that this would be the relationship of our lives, and you know, marriage is a piece of that for us.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, you know, and I think the thought was, you know, let's at least give it a try, and then if it's working, then we'll move on to the next step of marriage, and then hopefully start a family. And that was actually some of the questions that Susan first had for me when we first started sort of dating long distance, was, would be having a family be possible? And, you know, I had to tell her, I, at the time, I wasn't sure, actually, because, you know, I'd never really looked into that, because I hadn't mm-hmm. even expected to be alive that long. So
those are important questions. And actually, it was about to be my next question. I mean, Susan married a man who she knew was a hemophiliac, who she knew was HIV positive. How did the two of you kind of wrap your brains around that one? Because at that point, there really were no, not that there ever are, but there really were no guarantees.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think at first, you know, I think it's just sort of like, I'm almost thinking of the sort of what that saying, and I'm sure I'm not saying it quite correctly, but you know, how do you eat an elephant? And it's one bite at a time. So,
right.
Yeah, so it's the same kind of idea. You know, I think it was, we just sort of took it, you know, one step at a time, was sort of the long-term goal out there ahead of us, which was, you know, we'd like to have a family if possible. But, you know, let's just sort of deal with the here and now, which was getting me to California, you know, making sure that I was healthy, you know, making sure that Susan was comfortable with this whole process, and, you know, getting her questions answered, and then sort of, you know, moving on from there and starting to do the research about, you know, just what are the safe sexual practices, and then also what are the options for having a family, as I said. So, you know, just sort of one step at a time.
And
so you don't get overwhelmed.
It's easy to get overwhelmed. Was Susan healthy at that point?
Yes, Susan was, and she is, and Susan is HIV negative.
Okay.
And has obviously always been HIV negative. So, yeah. So, and then also part of what we started to bump against was that actually there wasn't a lot of research and or mm-hmm. Just general information out there about, you know, if you're in a committed relationship, you know, what are sort of the transmission rates for that group of people that are in monogamous, you know, committed relationships where, you know, the viral load is under control.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, so it, actually lots of, you know, time spent on the internet and talking to physicians and, you know, just really putting ourselves out there, because, you know, these were questions that we want answered, and a lot of people just, they didn't have them or didn't know where to find them.
So. Didn't have the answers. Now, at that point, were you taking antiviral medication?
Yes, I was, and I still am. So I've been taking my current antiviral medication that I'm on right now for the last 10 years and have been undetectable. So that was another thing that was working in our favor, was that my viral load was undetectable. And for people who don't know what that means, it means that, you know, when I get a blood test, that the test is not sensitive enough to detect any HIV virus in my blood. So it doesn't mean that I'm HIV negative or that it's gone. It just means that we don't have a test sensitive enough to find it. And the test is very sensitive. So it just means that HIV is just sort of lurking away and hiding somewhere that you know, is not easily found, but is under control.
So it's there, but it's under control.
Yes.
It's still kind of scary for you and your wife to have, well, let's talk about sex in general terms. Different people, different physicians, talk to the two of you about what were safe sexual practices. What did they tell you?
Basically they said use condoms and, if you want to have children, you're probably going to have to adopt. That brings up a whole other set of issues because some adoption agencies won't adopt out to an HIV positive couple or discordant couples. Adoption can also be very expensive. So, that's also when we started, and my wife also, she really wanted to experience being pregnant. Mm-hmm. So she, that's really when we started asking sort of those questions, sort of like, how come no one's done this research? And,
right.
And at this point she, had done a lot of research and was seeing that, there's some studies coming out of Africa that, that moms are having babies and they're HIV negative, but their husband is HIV positive, just sort of purely by accident. And so she spent a lot of time actually trying to track down somebody who mm-hmm. was more familiar with these studies and who might have been actually doing it here in the U.S. So.
And was she successful in finding anyone?
We were, actually. I think that's also part of where this whole thing about communication comes in again. And if you keep putting yourself out there and saying what it is that you're looking for, people start to hear you and they start to keep their ears and eyes out for you. And my infectious disease doctor, introduced us to someone at UCSF. Her name was Deborah Cohen, when we were actually testifying in California to have a law repealed, which at the time was the law was put into place was pretty groundbreaking in that it said that there weren't allowed to have any medical procedures done in California that would allow the transmission, that had any possibility of transmitting HIV. And obviously now that there were tests and medications and all that kind of stuff, that's just sort of an antiquated law. So we were testifying on behalf of having that law repealed. And Deborah Cohan was one of the doctors who was instrumental in drafting that legislation for having it repealed. And she was actually someone who was deep into this data and could give us a lot of data, at least at the data at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so we met her and actually offered to take her out to dinner. And even though she was not our physician and didn't give us any recommendations, at least she was the first person who could sit us down and be like, well, here's what the science is telling us right now, and here's the studies that we're doing and the research that we're getting. And she was on the front line working at, I can't remember the full thing, but the acronym is BAPAC, the Bay Area Perinatal AIDS Center.
Okay.
And, so she was working with HIV-positive moms and transmission rates and things like that here in the U.S. and then was also familiar with the transmission information that was happening in Africa and all that kind of stuff.
So she was really
able to just...
Yeah,
she was very knowledgeable and just able to sort of lay out, what our options were and... And it was actually just a really a great relief for both of us, but I would definitely say for Susan, who spent literally years trying to find someone like this and mm-hmm. having finally found her, to now have this information so that it, allow us to make an informed choice, which is ultimately what we wanted.
Which was really important, absolutely. Dan, we're going to take a break and we'll be right back and we will continue with your decision to have a baby.
Okay.
Dan, earlier in our conversation, you mentioned the term discordant. Can you explain to our listeners what HIV discordant means?
Oh, yeah. So HIV discordant couples means that one of the partners has HIV or is HIV positive, as they say in the lingo, and the other person does not have HIV or is HIV negative.
Okay. So you and your wife, after having spent a great deal of time researching, talking, I am sure, about this, made the decision to try to have a child. Now, there are all kinds of ways that people go about having children when there are difficulties. There's IVF. There are all kinds of things. What did the two of you ultimately do?
We ultimately decided to just do timed intercourse, you know, so Susan just started keeping a calendar of her menstrual cycle and also there are over-the-counter kits for testing, you know, just her hormone levels that give you a good guess of when you might be ovulating.
Okay.
And then just, you know, we just did timed unprotected sex.
So kind of the old-fashioned way.
Yeah, basically the old-fashioned way with, you know, a little more rigor to it than just, you know.
Sure.
Just let's try it any old day, time or day.
And during that time, were you getting any feedback from family and friends, or did they know that you were trying to conceive?
You know, I think we had talked to family about it in sort of the general sense. I don't know that we had talked to family about what we were specifically trying. And I know that Susan and I had talked about that we were going to try it this way for 6 months. And then if it wasn't working, we were going to stop and reevaluate, you know, all the while, you know, getting Susan HIV tested. And Susan still does do that just, you know, just to be safe.
We
were fortunate enough that actually after only 2 months, two tries, Susan got pregnant. So again, that whole luck thing, you know, we were just very lucky in that way.
Mm-hmm. So Susan got pregnant, and I think now you have a little girl.
Yes, we have an adorable 5-year-old. We love her very much. She's the joy of our life. So, yeah.
While you were trying to conceive, again, engaging in unprotected sex, knowing the chatter that just was around, were there times when you or Susan or both of you were particularly anxious or worried about what you were doing? Did you ever have doubts about what you were trying to do? Did you ever think about the potential risks of what you were trying to do?
Yes, we did have concerns about it, but we also we felt pretty confident in it. You know, and again, at the time, talking to Dr. Cohen, the likelihood, given the fact that we were in a monogamous relationship and that my viral load was undetectable and had been undetectable for a long time, the chance was like 1 in 1,000, you know, 1 in 1,000 per every try. So, you know, just to give some perspective to that, you know, you're probably more likely to die in an auto accident, you know, on your way to work than I was to transmit HIV to Susan.
Huh. So. Which, again, is really important, and I'm glad that you explained that, because even today, while I believe we have much more understanding and a broader perspective on HIV, still, there are some myths floating around, and there are still misconceptions about transmission and safety and relationships and options and all of that.
Absolutely. You know, and that's partly why we're willing to have this conversation, is not because, you know, we're dying to have our sex lives made public, but more because, you know, the technology is advancing so quickly, that really a lot of the problems that are around HIV, whether they're here in this country or in Africa or just worldwide, are much more of a social issue and in terms of how we deal with fear and information and our overall knowledge and comfort level. And I don't even want to limit it just to HIV, although that's what I'm familiar with. I mean, we could see if it happened with the Ebola outbreak that mm-hmm. happened on all the scares with the workers returning from there and people just not being informed and, you know, governors making very sort of rash decisions yeah. about what to do and not fully understanding the science behind things. So, again, that's why, you know, I'm here telling my story is again, not because I want to become the poster boy for this particular thing, but because I want right. people to know that there are options and that there is a broad spectrum in the HIV community and that what we did is not necessarily for everyone, but these are conversations that just even in the HIV community and in the gay community and in this country are not happening. What I would like to see happen more, which is, you know, looking more at the science and less at, you know, well, this is what happened in the past or, you know, really just starting that conversation.
So it sounds like you're wanting people to focus more on the possibilities and less on the fears.
Absolutely. And I don't think that, and when I say that, it doesn't mean that I'm telling people to be, that they shouldn't be afraid, because that actually never works. I mean, people are going to be afraid if they're going to be afraid.
Right.
But, what I want them to do is temper their fears or, you know, it's okay to have the fear, but then realize that the fear doesn't have to rule or run your reaction. You know, let the science sort of help guide you with that. So not that I'm out to tell anyone how to run their life or to behave, but mm-hmm. you know, the more informed you can be about any decision that you make, I always feel is much better, and especially in terms of your health, is always better. So
now at this point, your little one is 5 years old, and
yes.
she was born HIV negative.
Yes.
Your wife continues to be HIV negative. You continue to be HIV positive, albeit with an undetectable viral load, and you continue to be a hemophiliac.
That's correct.
Where do you go from here? Do you imagine that you would want to have more children? What kinds of things will you be telling your daughter? I think I'll just ask you maybe two questions at a time instead of 12.
Well, in terms of what I do now is I just continue to work on being healthy and monitoring myself and taking care of myself and, sort of doing what any sort of person my age, I'm 40 by the way, would do to plan for the future, regular doctor checkups and then to continue to monitor the HIV and the hemophilia as well. And then, you know, as our daughter gets older, we are, you know, we're trying not to hide anything from her. So mm-hmm. Part of being a hemophiliac is that I have to give myself an IV injection at home. And, you know, I've never hidden that from her. So
okay.
she knows about, you know, me giving myself medicine and all that kind of stuff. And we just try and tailor the message to a level that's appropriate for
sure.
her. And then, you know, as she gets older and has a better grasp and understanding of the world around her, you know, we'll continue to have conversations with her about what my HIV means and what it is. I mean, we haven't told her now just because right now she doesn't even fully understand what a cold is, much less have a grasp for what HIV is. And there's no point in sort of having to burden her or scare her with that kind of information. But again, as soon as she's old enough, we'll work on, you know, sort of letting her know about that. And since she's part of our family, I personally would like to involve her in the process that, you know, any family would make around, you know, making health decisions for a chronically ill member of the family.
Okay.
So.
and more children?
More children. Right now, we don't have that in the cards, but, you know, that's more of an economic decision than it is one of whether, you know, we would want to have more children. You know, it's not the HIV deciding that. It's more just sort of...
everyday life?
You know, whether, yeah, everyday life, you know, whether, you know, same decisions that all parents make of whether they want to have more children or not, you know. So.
What is a typical day like for you in terms of being healthy? What do you do to keep yourself healthy every day?
I swim, which is actually a good thing for hemophiliacs to do because that's low impact, but, you know, works your musculoskeletal system as well as, you know, it's good aerobics. I don't swim every day, but I try and swim at least twice a week. And then also, you know, it's making sure that I take my HIV medication, and Factor VIII is the name of the medication that I take for hemophilia, making sure that I take that on a regular basis. And also, you know, making sure that, you know, that I go to my doctor's appointments and make time for those and all that kind of stuff. And then, otherwise, I just sort of live my life sort of like any other quote-unquote normal person. You know, wake up in the morning and help my daughter get ready for school, take her to school, drop her off, go to work, you know, try and participate with my child after school, all that kind of stuff, and help with the dishes, yada, yada, yada.
You know, so many people, I think, take their health for granted. They might be sick, but if they don't have a diagnosis, they don't know, and they'll ignore themselves. I mean, I think, you know, we all know people like that. Do you ever get annoyed that you have to take particular care of yourself, or no? Does that not cross your mind?
Sometimes I do. It mostly shows up when it eats up a lot of my time, when I'm busy at a project at work and, you know, have a doctor's appointment that I have scheduled. And, you know, doctors are very busy people too. And so, you know, you still have to go to the doctor's appointment, even though you'd rather just postpone the doctor's appointment. Because then if you put it off for too long, then you just wind up not going. You know, and so to have to take a big chunk out of your day to go visit the doctor is not fun or exciting. I mean, that's often how it shows up. Or, you know, if I, you know, do have to sit down and infuse, you know, that's again, that's time that I could be reading or spending time with my family or whatever. And that's sort of annoying, but sort of otherwise, you know, I don't feel that, you know, that it's a pain. On a day-to-day basis, I don't feel like it's a pain to have to deal with these things, mostly because I've either had it my whole life in terms of the hemophilia because of, it's a genetic disorder, or with the HIV, it's been so long. And at this point, other than going to regular doctor's appointment, it's just one pill once a day that I have to take, you know, before bed. So I'm pretty lucky in that way. But
absolutely.
You know, I think, you know, maybe every once in a while when, you know, you have your down days or you're feeling a little blue, you know, it might sort of creep up and you just feel like, oh, man, I wish I didn't have to deal with all this kind of stuff.
Right.
But it's also hard to imagine what life would be like without it. So, yeah.
So you do what you do.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's just sort of like everybody else. You know, I'm sure if we talk to any member of your audience, you know, I'm sure we could find something that was a struggle for them to have to deal with at times. But yet they, you know, the rest of us would be like, gosh, I have no idea how I would deal with that. You know, sort of like I think of it in terms of like, I have no idea how single parents manage being single parents and holding down a job and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But they do it, and you know
they do what they do.
They don't even think about it.
That's true.
So, I think this is sort of the same kind of thing.
Dan, we're going to take a break, and we will be right back, folks. Pamela Brewer, you're listening to Mind Talk. Stay where you are. We'll be back in a moment. Dan, just before the break, I was asking you about a typical day. Is there a typical diet that you engage in, or is it just general healthy foods?
Just general healthy foods. You know, we try and have a lot of fruits and vegetables around in the house, and, you know, we eat meat, but we don't eat a ton of it, and we mostly eat chicken. But again, that's just us trying to be generally healthy in terms of our diet. It's not specifically because of, you know, any of my conditions or any of that kind of stuff.
When you think about the awareness in the world today in terms of the fact of HIV, what's missing as far as you're concerned? Is there anything missing? Do we know enough?
What's missing? Well, I think we still don't fully understand how this virus mutates. And, you know, we definitely know how to hold this at bay, but we haven't figured out how to sort of stop this, or like we have recently with hepatitis C.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I think that's a missing, at least for me, you know, because I really would rather have be HIV negative if possible.
Sure.
And then also I think what's missing is that there's still a lot of past-based conversations about HIV in the health community as well that are just not happening right now. Or that should not be happening right now, or that need to be altered in some way. And I don't necessarily have the answer for how those conversations need to shift, but I do feel like that is a missing in the HIV community, you know, because there is things like pre-exposure prophylactics, which is just basically taking an HIV medication, even if you're HIV negative, to help prevent transmission. And especially in the gay community, there are derogatory terms for people who are on those medications. And instead of the conversation being about how is that allowing people, you know, because that, to me, occurs as that's a lifestyle judgment and not a scientifically based judgment of that, yes, this actually is working. So, you know, a doctor refusing to prescribe that, even though the science seems very sound, because you don't think that gay men should be out having lots and lots of sex with different men, it occurs to me as a missing sort of conversation, and a conversation that the country and the HIV community is not having on a regular basis, because, you know, that's, again, really just a lifestyle judgment. And I think as a physician, that's not your job to judge somebody's particular lifestyle. Your job is, you know, you have tools, which is, you know, Truvada, to give to this person. And therefore, you know, there's no reason that you shouldn't give it to them if it's effective.
You know, as I hear you talking about the fact that there are some docs who, for their own personal reasons, won't prescribe a particular medication, I wish that I could be surprised, but of course it's not surprising, because we're way too often hearing stories about doctors allowing their own personal views to influence their professional treatment of their clients. And it really is, at least from where I sit, quite unfortunate and kind of not okay.
Yeah, I would agree with that, you know, and I think the hard thing for any of us to also wrap our head around in some ways is that doctors are people first, and so they have all the biases that the rest of us have, and doctors, you know, whether they realize it or not, often think and lead and react with that, even though we would like them to just sort of be these sort of caring, sort of scientifically accurate machines. They're not. And so on the one hand, it's like I can fully understand it, but I don't want to excuse it either.
Understood.
So I think once we start to understand that the doctors are not machines and that they are people and they have their biases just like everyone else, you can start to open up these conversations.
What about insurance? Is that something that is difficult for you to acquire or no?
It used to be with my chronic illnesses, but now due to the what's properly known as Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, insurance is no longer allowed to deny me health care, which has actually been a huge stress reducer for me. So given the expense of these medications, I could never afford them without insurance. So insurance is something that I always pay attention to and mm-hmm. and have been paying attention to as you know, all these changes happen. So it's I am one of the people who's actually very much in favor of the Affordable Care Act because it does benefit me, and I think it actually is going to benefit the country overall on a whole because it's going to start this conversation that we haven't been having
exactly.
about the cost of health care in this mm-hmm. country.
I'm curious as to whether or not your wife or your daughter, if there was difficulty in getting insurance for them prior to the Affordable Care Act as a result of your diagnoses.
No, actually, because you know they're both quote unquote healthy, so getting okay. insurance for them hasn't been an issue. And you know, and the other thing that has always worked for me before the Affordable Care Act was that I was working, so I could be part of my employer's group mm-hmm. health insurance. Mm-hmm. And the law even back then was that you know you can't deny an individual that's part of a group health insurance plan. You have to deny the whole group.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's how I got around the whole pre-existing conditions issue. And so for them, you know, they pretty much have always had what you would think of as a sort of typical health insurance
okay.
experience because they're both healthy and
There are certainly people who will have today may have any number of things going on with them, whether it's physical or emotional, and may not choose to disclose that to an employer for fear that they won't be hired, that they'll be discriminated against. Even though it's against the law, we all know there's law and there's law.
Right.
What do you say to folks who might be in your shoes, might be a hemophiliac or HIV or both, as you are? Do you disclose? Do you not?
I would say that, you know, it really depends on you and your personality and then you're also your particular situation. You know, I think it helps to have at least someone in your workplace know, just you know, in case you need to leave or whatever. But mm-hmm. I do believe that you know you can be perfectly fine and live your whole life working without disclosing that you have either HIV or hemophilia or any sort of chronic illness at work. You know, because ultimately, unless it's going to affect your work in some way, you know, in terms mm-hmm. of having to go to doctor's appointments mm-hmm. and you know, you can always be just purposely vague about why you're having to go to all these doctor's appointments. You know, it really has no bearing on how you function at work. So
right.
it's really a matter of how that works for you emotionally and the relationship that you have with your colleagues and your management and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, I wouldn't want to say that, yes, you absolutely should disclose or, you know, no, you shouldn't. I think it's, you know, you really have to take it on a case-by-case basis.
It's an individual choice.
Yes, absolutely.
Dan, in the couple of moments that we have left, for those listening who might be in a similar situation as you and your wife, Susan, HIV discordant, one partner has it, one partner does not, if they want to have a child, is there a first step that you would sort of routinely recommend to folks?
I would recommend that they go check, you know, go online, actually, and check out BayPAC and, you know, talk to your physician. And if they don't have the information, push them to get the information and or, you know, find a physician who is willing and or has the information about what's available. You know, it may be as simple as your partner going on Truvada for a while you try. And, you know, because really each person, you know, depending on their viral load and how new both of you are to this relationship, but really is just arm yourself with the information, especially since the technology is changing all the time and new studies are coming out with new research, is really just arm yourself with information and then sit down and have a conversation with your partner and then make a decision from there and then have, preferably with your partner with you, have a conversation with whatever physicians you need to be involved in that process, whether it's your primary care physician and or your infectious disease doctor and your OBGYN, and just, you know, just let everyone know that you think needs to know that's going to be involved in the process about what you're deciding and your plans and you know, basically make sure you get your team lined up and then
gotcha.
And then just move forward with whatever it is that you decide.
And are you saying BayPAC is an area, is an organization to check out?
Yes, it's a nonprofit based out of UCSF that you know, does a lot of this work. They work a lot with HIV positive women who are pregnant, but there's also I'm blanking on it, but there's a doctor in Houston that's doing a lot of this research as well, and working with people. So, and I think it's early days, but it's becoming more and more of a thing where now, you know, it's not just HIV is something that you can live with, but it's now something where it's time to get the word out that if you're HIV positive and you have your HIV under control and you want to have a family, it's now possible and that there are resources and technology available to make that happen.
That you can live and have a family with. Are you saying, would you spell BayPAC for us? Are you saying, well, tell me what you're saying.
It's BPAC, I think is
okay.
It's the Bay Area, or BAPAC, the Bay Area Prenatal Center.
Okay. That's enough for folks to be able to get online and do a search.
Yes.
All right. Thank you so much, Dan Hartman, and to your wife as well, for being willing to share your story. Certainly with candor and with passion and with compassion. So I thank you both for that.
Thank you.
Folks, you have been listening to this edition of Mind Talk, and I thank you for listening and joining us as well. Remember, you can always listen to Mind Talk on demand at mindtalk.org. The managing producer is Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. Mind Talk is provided daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace treatment with a licensed medical or mental health professional. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. That's 301-654-5286. For more information, you can always go to mindtalk.org. And please remember, if it is unacceptable, then that is indeed what it is. Unacceptable.